This is Cheryl McQuaid with the Lansing Fisher Body Historical Team. It is November 10th, 2005, Thursday, at approximately 8:10 a.m. We're in the Labor Relations Conference Room here at Fisher Body. Also present in the room,
Mike Fleming,
Doreen Howard,
Linda Johnson,
Marilyn Coulter,
John Fedor,
Doug Rademacher.
And we are going to interview Tom Kerrigan. Tom, would you state your name and spell your last name for the record, please?
Okay, Tom Kerrigan, C-A-R-R-I-G-A-N.
And what is your address?
7338 Kinzel Highway, Vermontville, Michigan.
Are you married? Do you have children?
I was married when I left the house this morning, so I would assume I still am. I've got three kids that are all doing super good.
And did you ever spend any time in the military?
Nope.
How about your educational background? Could you get us a little bit of that?
I made it through high school and then some college for my apprenticeship.
What's your seniority date at Fisher Body?
8/7/78.
Do you remember why you put an application here?
Because I was starving to death. I was working at a place doing something that was really fun. It was steel fabrication work, but it was paying $4.50 an hour. My first paycheck here, I think I hired in at 8 something or other. So I more than doubled what I was making the instant I walked in the door.
So money was the motivator. And tell us about your first day walking in the door. Do you remember?
Oh, I remember it really clear. I ended up in the body shop on a gun that was probably 5 feet long, welding floor pans. And after that day, I wondered, why on earth did I do this? But by the second day, I thought, I can do this.
And so you hired into the body shop?
Yep.
Day shift, night shift?
Day shift, but I had wrote all over my applications that I wanted to work nights, so they hired me on days.
How long were you on days?
A year and a half.
Wow. Wow. And how long did you stay on that floor pan job?
5 days. Then I came back, got laid off for changeover for 2 weeks, and when I came back, they asked me if I could MIG weld, and I said sure, so they put me offline MIG welding on a real good job that nobody could bump me. So I lasted on that 7 months.
Excellent. How much time did you spend in the body shop?
Almost 2 years. Then I went from the MIG welding, I got bumped onto a job that I couldn't blow my nose in between cars, and I was on that like 3 weeks, and then I went to night shift, ended up on a pretty decent spot welding job, and then I went on utility for probably about 8 or 9 months.
Do you remember any of your bosses in that time?
Thess Nicholson, what was that other guy's name? I had two more, but I can't think of them. But they'll probably come back here after a while.
Did any pranks get pulled on you when you first hired in, or did you see any pranks being pulled on anybody?
I was never one much for horseplay around. I wanted to come to work and do a good job and go home. That was my biggest interest.
Doreen Howard.
Can you describe the body shop area at the time when you first hired in? What was the atmosphere like down there? What was some of the machines and things that you worked with?
I did mostly spot welding. Some of the guns were really big and heavy and weren't hung very good, but most of them weren't that bad to run, especially once I got on utility. I got to where I could learn a job sometimes by watching it once or twice. And if the guns were hung okay, it really wasn't that bad of work. One thing I did like about it was you worked with your eyes and your body, but your mind was completely free to wander wherever you wanted to.
Linda Johnson.
When did you decide that you wanted to be a skilled tradesperson and not just work in the body shop?
The first day I worked here, because the guy that I replaced had worked on the line for 28 and a half years, and he was going on sanitation. I said, I can't do this that long. I got to do something immediately. So that's when I started the application process.
And what did that involve?
You had to take a test, and then depending on how you scored on the test, I had to take some classes, and then I got to take the test over. And on one part of it, they told me on the pasteboard pattern of it that that's an inborn ability. It's like spatial relationships. It was an inborn ability, and I didn't have it. Well, after taking a drafting class and doing a little studying and drawing some stuff, I zipped right through that part of the test the next time, and that gave me enough points to get in. So if somebody tells you that you can't have it or you can't learn it, don't believe them.
That's a good story. So how long did it take before you got into, you said you worked in the body shop a couple of years before.
Then I worked in paint probably about 3 months in a paint booth. And then I got in. And I was really fortunate because at the time, after I hired into skill trades, they put on enough people that the day I graduated my apprenticeship, I could hold any shift I wanted, where it used to take maybe 20 years to get off afternoon. So that worked out good for me.
Yeah. And your trade is?
Pipe fitter.
As a skilled tradesperson, did you experience good working relationships with women that were coming on in the trades? They were coming on about the same time, were they?
Shortly afterwards. Okay. I think the next batch of apprentices, maybe.
Do you know how you the guys felt about it, or
some people
yourself?
Some people seem to have a big problem with it, but for me, it didn't make any difference at all. If they wanted to work, I could care less. You know, I didn't get a choice on what color I was born or what gender, and nobody else did that I know of. So, I mean, it's just totally irrelevant to me.
Marilyn, did you have a question? So, can you tell us a little bit more about hiring in on the line? Did you think that helped you when you went into the skilled trades arena, knowing the line and the culture of the line, the people? Did that help at all?
I think it gave me a lot of respect for what line people do, but I probably would have had it anyways. But I'll guarantee you, after working on the line and getting poor service out of the maintenance department sometimes, I'll never give somebody on the line a hard time. If they want something done, if there's any way I can get it done, I'd be more than happy to do it.
That sounds pretty strong. What were your feelings about being on the line? And the maintenance, you had some bad problems with the maintenance department?
Well, when I first hired in, it took me 89 days to get a fan. Now, I don't know if that was just because they were that busy during changeover or just I got put on the back shelf. But when I came out and looked at my fan, it blew so far over my head, it did me absolutely no good whatsoever. So then it took about a week to get it moved. And in the meantime, I'm standing there breathing all this welding smoke. And then I had a chest x-ray for some other troubles I was having. And from the time I hired in until that time, my lungs went from crystal clear to jet black.
Ooh.
So if somebody wants a fan mounted, if I was their fan mounter, I'd make sure it blew exactly where they wanted it, you know.
It seems like the company would too.
You would think so, but there's some skilled trades people that have the attitude that the line people are trash, and to me that's ridiculous. You know, because the only reason I'm here is because you people are here.
Marilyn Coulter.
When you say that, you know, some of them have the thought that the line people are trash, is that because, do you think that that's because they came from the outside, or were they people who came from the inside, like worked the line and then made their way to trades like you did versus somebody who came straight in off the street?
Looks to me like it's about 50-50 one way or the other, which is kind of surprising. It's some people forget where they came from, I think.
Michael Fleming.
Hi, Tom. have you ever been laid off since you hired in here?
I was laid off like a month or so. I don't think it was the first year. I think it was the second year at Christmas time. And then other than that, the only layoff I had was when that one plant went on strike and we were out of here 5 weeks.
How was the, you talked about changeovers. Explain changeover and working a changeover and how many types of hours that you did there.
Most of the changeovers I ended up working because being in skilled trades. And most of the time, from a month before until a month after, we were on 7 days a week. So during my apprenticeship, most of the time there was overtime available. And after it, it was kind of hit and miss. But most, I'd say I worked a lot of 7 days a week, especially the first 10 years. So I never got the all summer off type changeover thing. We were here every day.
What did you have family that worked here?
Actually, my wife hired in while she was my girlfriend. She worked in the cushion room and then ended up in paint. Then we got married, and after the third baby, she quit. She's been home ever since.
So she hired in as your girlfriend. You didn't meet her in here?
No.
Okay. And you didn't have any other family?
Nope. No relation, no family, nobody.
Marilyn Calder.
Question. Given the fact that you said you worked on the line and then you worked in skilled trades and you're here 7 days a week, because you're here so much, did you develop any long-standing relationships with coworkers that become, you know, outside friends as well as inside?
Not really. I mean, I consider them good friends at work, but there's really only been about one guy that we've ever done anything with. Once in a while, we'll go to something, but it just didn't work out that way. I seem to stay busy enough at home with the people I know and my people in my church and that sort of thing that there just isn't enough time.
So do you think the environmental conditions, when you hired into the body shop, how much has that changed to present day?
Environment, you mean how? Like the attitudes? Or
well,
like the
when you said that you had the x-rays taken and your lungs went from crystal to black, do you think that an employee that maybe hired in 95 would have seen that same thing?
Probably not. I mean, that was kind of an unusual job I was on that was so smoky, welding on the dash panels. But I think as time went on, the air got a lot cleaner. You know, of course, now there's so many robots to do the welding, so there's not near as many people exposed to it near as much as they used to be. So overall, even the chemicals, there's less and less harmful chemicals in here all the time. So I think overall, you know, the environment is a lot better than it used to be. And I think in the future at the new plant, it'll be a whole lot better.
Linda Johnson.
Wait, that's a good point that you had made right there, and I just want to emphasize it, that in the when you hired in, how many robots were there in the body shop? And then as things got better in 95, how many robots were there doing the former manual work?
I think they put the first robot in my department after I hired in. But then they went to the hydraulic robots, and they must have had, I'm just guessing, 200 or 300 of those. Now, since 95, I don't know how many. We've had 500, 600 of them. So, you know, the real smoky, heavy work pretty much seemed to disappear.
Michael Fleming.
Can you talk about some of the safety that goes along with working with the other trades and in the body shop, and if you've seen any fatalities through your tenure here?
They had the one contractor get killed.
Where was that?
Up in 3X. But that was really a deal. He was working on something and he really didn't have it locked out and he got pinched in a conveyor. But I think that's the only one I can think of.
Mike Fleming, what is lockout? Talk about that. Talk about that procedure and what made that you know of it happened.
Okay, well, when I first hired in, there really wasn't any push for any kind of lockout. I mean, you turn a piece of equipment off, hopefully it was off. There was no way to guarantee it was off. And I seen in skilled trades where they first started their lockout program to where you had to actually put a lock on equipment. But most of the equipment that was in our plant was never even designed to be locked out in the first place. So, I mean, this company spent a lot of money on training and a lot of money on trying to get a good program in force. And now I think we have a wonderful program if you can get people to use it. But as far as, like, the contractor deal, he probably should have had somebody watching, and it's just one of these deals with a conveyor running that he should have been aware that he might have been in a bad spot. Apparently he had his back turned, and the next thing you know, he's tangled up in it.
Dorian Howard.
As a pipe fitter, do you work in one specific department all the time, or do you move throughout the plant and go to different departments? How does that arena work as far as the skilled trades employees?
For me, how it worked, as an apprentice, I moved around and worked in all the different areas at least a little bit. And then wherever my seniority would let me go, I got to choose what department and what shift I worked on. But I'm also the kind of person that I'm better off if I'm learning stuff. So if I got comfortable in an area, it was time to move. So I basically worked on almost all of the equipment in the whole plant at one time or another. Some people feel a lot more comfortable just being in an area and staying there. I could have done that, but not me. I'd rather be learning and something new all the time. I also worked as a lockout coordinator for 6.5 years. You know, and that was something that was really totally out of my comfort zone as far as I got to learn a lot of stuff on the computer. I got to learn 2 different CAD programs and made several thousand lockout placards. But I got to understand the electrical part of it a lot better and the mechanical parts, and so that was a good deal for me. But it was a learning experience, but the main reason I quit it is I got to the point I wasn't learning enough. So it's time to go do something else.
Dory.
As a pipe fitter, what does your job entail? What do you do on a daily basis for a pipe fitter?
Well, every day is different. If you look in this factory, there's thousands of miles of pipe. I mean, we work on things like hydraulics, a little bit, not much. Most of the building is steam heated, so there's all kinds of steam lines, all the stuff that goes with that. We take care of the fire system, so there's all kinds of fire lines. Every time a fork truck hits one or something, you know, they call us. In the paint department, we worked on, like, all of the paint-type turbo valves, the old reciprocator machines, rebuilt spray guns, worked in the paint mix room. You know, anything from the roof to the tunnels, we worked on. We used to do more construction than what we do now. Now most of our construction jobs are just little ones. But even in the front offices, I mean, we take care of the bathrooms and the heat in the ceiling. So basically, anything that flows through a pipe is what we take care of.
Mike Fleming.
When you talked about the industrial accidents with the fork trucks hitting water mains or pipes, can you think of any specific ones that come to mind that had happened within the plant while you were here?
Oh, there was a lot of fire lines that would get clipped, but considering how many miles and how narrow our aisleways are and how much, you know, material had to flow through here every day, I think they actually did an excellent job trying to avoid it. But I probably fixed 20 different sprinkler lines that have got hit over the years.
Any large main lines that it ever...
Not any big major one that got busted.
Sure.
What happens when a sprinkler line gets hit? How much water goes through that?
The heads are rated at 50 gallons a minute. So you can get a flood in a hurry, but if they bust off like a 2-inch pipe or something, you're talking a lot of water.
Could you tell me, what is your best memory of Fisher Body, of working here?
I don't know if I have any best one, but when I was in a job that I could give good customer service, you know, when somebody wanted something fixed, I could fix it in a hurry. That's the kind of things that made my job fun. our maintenance department sometimes doesn't support this effort. Our parts have been in kind of a state of disarray ever since I hired in. There's little glimmers of hope. I hope at the new plant they get it straightened out. But I would rather do 10 jobs in a day versus one job because I had to look for parts all day long.
Did you ever do any government jobs for people?
As stuff for home, hardly ever, but if, like when I worked in the CI crib, now thinking about it, that was probably one of my favorite places to work for several reasons. Number one, 95% of what I needed to do the job was at my fingertips, so I cut all the hunting and wandering around the plant looking for stuff, but I could also, lots of times, build something for somebody that made their job easier for them. So there was a great satisfaction in that.
What is a CI crib?
They called it the Continuous Improvement Crib, but the material we use is called Creaform. It's a system of tubing and clamps and wheels and fittings. It's almost like an older person's erector set. And you can build almost anything that you can imagine. So that was a job where I got to use my creativity too.
Michael Fleming.
If I can remember right, you were out in Trim in the CI area.
Yeah, when it was 3X and downstairs.
Yes. And you all had a team with, if I'm not mistaken, with some production folks and with, can you talk about that, how that worked out? What kind of process was that that you had there?
Well, when we were upstairs in Trim in 3X, we had a production guy that he would go out and talk to the people if somebody requested something built, and he would figure out what he thought they needed. And 9 times out of 10, I would wholeheartedly agree with him. So I got to spend all my time building stuff. That worked excellent. You know, but I'd go out and still look at the job real quick just before I started. Once in a while, we'd talk it over and maybe change a little bit of it, but not much. So that guy was excellent. Well, kind of have a little shortage of manpower. He got taken out of the crib. And then I had to do all the customer service part, which I didn't mind that, but I would much rather just build stuff faster. Because you can take a lot of time by the time you, you know, talk to the day shift and talk to the night shift and stand there and watch them work a while and figure out what material I have and how you're going to do it and all that sort of thing. But as far as I've always had a good relationship, you know, with the production guys, like the ones downstairs, we got along great.
Doreen Howard.
You've been here during all the name changes of this facility. What's your feelings about that?
I kind of have mixed emotions. I mean, Fisher Body was a thing. That's, I still say I work at Fisher Body. At least most people know what plant you're talking about. I understand sometimes why you have to rearrange things, but I think part of it is people want to shuffle the way we do business without really understanding what we do. I mean, we've been, started out Fisher Body, then we were at BOC, so now all of a sudden we're trying to group three groups of people that never talked to one another before into one cohesive unit. I don't know how well that worked, but as far as, then we're what, LCA now? I don't even know what we are or what we were when we closed. I guess as long as I keep getting a paycheck, that's the biggest thing.
Were you ever involved in any of the union activities or with the union?
Yeah, not much. It just seemed like between trying to raise my three kids and take care of my place and living out of town and stuff, I just never got involved. Maybe I should have, I don't know. I've been to a number of union meetings, but other than that.
Doreen Howard.
You just touched base on living out of town. Did you happen to carpool?
Yes, actually I did with a number of different people, but the best setup I ever had was with Al Simpson. He was right on the way. If I wasn't there by a certain time, he left. If I got there and it turned out he had to drive separate or something, you know, he just drove. It was a wonderful situation. Plus, the guy was super intelligent. And we would talk electrical stuff or talk conveyors and talk, you know, especially when I was on lockout. it's like I had Einstein sitting next to me on the way to work, and I could just fire question after question after question.
Linda Johnson.
Well, was he a skilled tradesman also?
Yeah, he's an electrician. He was the first apprentice they hired from the outside, that he never did work on the line.
Michael Fleming.
What was his name again?
Al Simpson. And he might even be interested in doing one of these interviews. I don't know. You call him up.
Does anybody have any more questions?
Are you going to be going to Delta Township?
Yep.
And what will your job be when you go there?
I'm going to work in facilities, which basically will be taking care of the three buildings. I won't be directly related to production people hardly at all. So I'm not exactly sure what all the job entails because nobody seems to know yet.
So, but still a pipe fitter, but
yeah,
for
I'll
the
be
whole
pipe
facilities.
Fitting. Yep. But I'll be working in all three of the buildings, which we'll be the only group that's going to work in all three buildings. So I'll get to see the whole thing from one end to the other.
Michael Fleming.
By having that opportunity to work in all three buildings, how would you get from building to building? Because there seems to be somewhat of a mystery of how that happens. Do you have any idea how that's going to happen?
Not for sure. The way they do it across the street, they have a golf cart they drive around at Lansing Grand River. I'm hoping to get a bike. If I could have a little three-wheel bike, I could go like crazy. The paint department's going to be hard to get in because you're going to have to suit up and all that. But other than that, probably most of what we'll do in the paint department, though, is going to be in the office and not the actual plant.
Doug Rademacher.
We've worked here many, many years now. Lansing has been known to be the highest productivity plant in North America. They've also been known for the capital of quality. Can you tell, in your opinion, what makes Lansing special and what makes the Fisher Body Lansing plant work?
I think it's the people's attitudes is the biggest thing. You know, 98% of the people in here really just want to come to work and do their job and go home. Now, after growing up in Detroit and seeing some of the people's attitudes down there, it's no wonder, you know, we can outperform a lot of them. But I think it's the biggest thing is just the people that work here. I don't think the management's probably much better. Maybe they are. I don't know. But it's the individual people that build the cars are the ones that seem to have their heart in it.
There's all different walks of life, different genders, different races. What do you think that is? Why does it all come together in Lansing and seem to work together? Do you have any ideas?
I think it still boils down to the people's attitudes. I guess after growing up in Detroit and after the riots, seeing how the whole attitude changed down there, one reason I won't live in Detroit is the people's attitudes. So I don't know if it's just that in the central area up here, I mean, a lot of people live out of town. You know, a lot of people had jobs before they ever hired in here or worked on farms and worked here and there. And I just think between the talent of the people, you know, because they are so diversified, that and their attitudes is what makes it tick.
Doreen Howard.
You've been here for a long time, and you've seen a lot of changes that have happened here. You're one of the last few people in this building, and you can look around, and there's darkness and not a whole lot going on. What is your feelings about the closing of this facility and the demolition of this building?
I mean, I have a lot of memories here, and I've learned a lot here. And overall, it's been a very good place to work. General Motors has taken very good care of me. But as far as this plant is a dead horse, it's totally inefficient. And if we're going to compete in the new world and whatever, this new facility, it looks to me like it's going to run so much smoother once they get the kinks out of it. It'll be the best thing that ever happened to it. And I guess as far as my only regret about the plant is, it's not big enough they could implode it so I could watch. So, I mean, I don't have any feelings about the building or anything anymore at all. It's been really good to me, but it's time to move on.
Let's go to Well, Tom, thank you very much for being available for us.
Sure.
Tom, glad
you're
here.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Tom, could you tell us a little bit about the powerhouse and the energy that we used to make here?
We burnt coal to make our steam. That's back when we had the coal pile. There's either 4 or 5 boilers. I can't remember exactly. But we used them to produce steam for this plant, plant 2, and I think we also did plant 3. And we produced compressed air for this plant. There was approximately 5,600 horsepower worth of air compressors. They didn't all run all of the time, but that's how much we had available. And the powerhouse also made DI water, which is deionized water. It's almost like distilled. They use a lot of that in the paint department and the Bondurite area.
Doug Rademacher, can you talk about the use of coal was considered pollution, and we made an effort, I think, is to get away from that. Can you tell us about the change that that took place here?
They run a steam line from the Board of Water and Light over here to the corner of our building, and they sent it over as high-pressure steam and then reduced it once we got in the plant. But we had two different, basically, steam systems, a high-pressure system and a low-pressure system. The high is about 175 PSI, and the low was 20 pounds. Most of the low went for heat and that sort of thing. The high went for some process steam, but a lot of it heated the paint booths, which the way our paint booths were set up were kind of an energy waster. But also, one reason why our powerhouse had a little trouble, our steam load changed so drastically. From the time the plant was just sitting here idled, like at 2 o'clock Sunday morning, from the time then to when they started painting cars in the winter, there's a lot of difference. So, I mean, they were always turning boilers on and off, and that's probably part of the reason why they wanted to get rid of them. Because a boiler would work better if you could start it up, run it at a certain speed, and keep it that way, or a certain temperature, with a, you know, pretty constant load, where our load fluctuated so much. So if you saw the smoke coming out of the stacks, that's why.
Doug Rademacher.
Did you ever have to work in the chutes for the coal, or the I guess they call it a mill or something that drew the coal down into the shafts and then back up into the conveyor systems?
I was never in any of that equipment, except I crawled all over it because I did all the lockout stuff on it. So I've been to the bottom of the bottomless part of the powerhouse to the highest part of the roof on the powerhouse.
Michael Fleming.
You mentioned Plant 2 as, you know, the steam that we generated, we supplied them with. Talk about that line that runs from the powerhouse over there, and who maintains all of that?
We actually maintain it, or we used to. It runs through a tunnel, but then comes back out of the ground once it gets over there. But towards the end, you know, once we got a good confined space program and that sort of thing, it was a lot harder to just jump down in the tunnel and go to work, which is really a good thing because, I mean, I've been in the tunnel that ran from the powerhouse to trim in the summer. I don't know how hot it is, but you sweat the instant you step into it, and you just pour sweat out the whole time.
Dorian Howard.
You talked about confined space program. Could you elaborate on that a little bit more? And can you also describe how big this tunnel is? What size are you talking about as far as going into the tunnel?
There's about enough room for the 6 or 8 big pipes that go through it and you to squeeze by it. It goes from the center of trim over all the way to the powerhouse. But with our confined space program, you know, we used to just jump in a hole and didn't think twice about it. And now thinking about fatalities, I forgot about the people that died in the paint booth. That was a case where we didn't have any confined space, we didn't have the rescue equipment ready. People jumped in, and the next thing you know, a couple went down, a couple more jumped in to help them. I think we've, what, lost 3 that time?
I think you're right.
Yeah, the fourth one almost died, and he was an apprentice that went through the apprenticeship with me. So, I mean, the confined space, that's just another thing, like lockout. when I first hired in, safety didn't seem to be a push at all. But, I mean, we work so much safer now than we ever did. It's incredible.
Dorian Howard.
So the tunnels were, what, maybe 8 foot across?
Oh, it's probably right? 6 foot wide and 6 or 7 foot high.
And you said they go from the middle of the trim to the powerhouse? And
there are pipes running through that pipe?
You're probably never aware of it and walked right by it.
how much distance is that from the trim to the powerhouse?
Must be more than 100 yards, I would think.
So it's long and big.
Yeah. Okay. There's another one that comes out by the down, by the, where you head up the escalator to the cafeteria. There's steam lines that go from there over the powerhouse, too.
Michael Fleming.
What about the ones that go to plant two? Where do they originate from and how do they get there?
Actually, you can go all the way from the powerhouse to the driveway. It comes out of the ground on the next to the driveway on the other side of the railroad tracks. I've never been all the way through that one, but...
Doug Rademacher.
Did you ever find any tunnels that you'd never heard about, or a surprise? Something that surprised you, that you know, the old plant, this plant's got buildings built over buildings and probably tunnels built over tunnels. Did you ever find something that you'd never heard about, or was it a surprise to find?
I heard there was a big hole underneath the store, Stores W, where we got our parts from and whatever. And I had the opportunity to go down in one day, and apparently they used to pull trains in there. I mean, that was a big hole down in there. There's also some tunnels out in trim. I mean, in the body shop. But not very many, really, that I've seen.
And also, you said there was a line running to plant two, possibly plant three. It's going underground because of the transportation system out there? Is that
the railroad tracks. Yeah, it goes under the railroad tracks and then comes up. See, I don't know when they tear this building down, if they're going to tear it down, they have to leave the corner out there on Building 21 because that's where the steam comes from the border water and light, and there's a reducing station and all that, and then it goes to two, and I think it still goes to three. So I don't know what they're going to do on that corner. Nobody's been able to answer that yet for me.
And the reason you say that is because they're still in production at those facilities.
Correct? Yep. You're talking, I don't know how big that line is, 24-inch line or something, and all the equipment that goes with it. So somehow that part of the corner's got to stay. Or as far as the electricity and all that, the substation out in the parking lot supplies plant two and this plant, so that's going to have to stay.
I've walked by out by Building 28, which is a location where they bring parts in. There's some huge turbines out there. Can you explain what those do?
Which ones do you mean?
Between the building and...
That's the incinerators.
Okay.
Yeah, what they do is they burn the paint fumes. The paint fumes from the paint booths. Originally, they used to just blow all that stuff out of the roof. But then, now we burn the fumes out of the paint booths. So whatever air goes past the water system and all that in the booth is piped over there, and it's actually burned at a high temperature. That reduces, you know, the amount of pollution we put out.
So, Michael Fleming.
So those are fairly new?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Even if they are, will they be utilized when we go to our new plant, or are they just going to... What do you have any idea what they'll do with those?
I heard one of them's going to Flint, but at our new plant, they have something similar, but the way our new paint is, our Elpo is water-based, which is good. Of course, our Elpo here was, too. But then the primer is going to be powder-coated, so there's almost no pollution involved in that. I think the color is actually water-based, so that cuts down the pollution. The only thing that's going to have solvent-based is their clear coat. And they're going to have either incinerators, they call it a catalyzed something or other. But it's basically an incinerator to burn the fumes for that. So that's all been installed at the new plant already.
Doug Rademacher, have we forgot to ask you anything? Is there something that you'd like to share? Do you have a comment for people that are going to listen to this or read this later on that have never been a part of the auto industry? What do you say to people about the auto industry in 2005?
If we get our act together on our quality, but I mean, it's got to be designed in to start with. I think some of the times over the years, I look at GM built some stuff that really wasn't very good because we were still sticking to the mentality that we had 60% of the market and we could pump out any kind of junk and it would sell. You know, I look back at like a 73 Vega. You know, I don't know of anybody that would tell you that was a good car. But a 73 Opel was almost identical, but it was a tremendous car. And even years later, when I was going through my apprenticeship, in the LCC parking lot, there was one Vega and 13 Opels. Now, what would have happened if the Vega would have been as good a car as an Opel? And you look at some of the ones about the time the gas went sky high, the first time gas embargo, our cars were getting really poor gas mileage. You know, if you look at some of the things like that have happened, you know, the diesel motors and the Holzes, the first ones they had were trash. I mean, they blew up almost instantly. There's a bunch of people that got burned on those. We came out with a good engine, but by then nobody wanted a diesel. So quad fours are another sore spot with me. The first time I saw one of those engines, I thought, if this thing has a good head gasket, it's going to be a tremendous engine. That's the one part it didn't have. So I really think things have changed a lot. I mean, like now, I bought a pickup with 200,000 miles on that has no rust holes, runs good down the road, doesn't use hardly any oil at all. So I look at how much we've improved our vehicles. We've done a tremendous job improving them, but we still can't sit still. We got to keep improving. But as far as to work at General Motors, this company has really been really good to me. I mean, I could have went in management, I'm sure, if I wanted to. I could have, with the TAP program and the college, I could have a master's degree in almost any field I chose and wouldn't have had to pay for it. You know, I look at the benefits, you know, the insurance and everything. It has been a tremendous, you know, opportunity to work here. But the only way we're going to keep it going is if we keep improving.
Thank you.
Thank you, Tim.
Thanks, Tim.
All right.